Okay, I'm Joe Broadhurst. You're listening to CKUT Radio in Montreal, Quebec. I am pleased to be joined on the phone this afternoon with James Fetzer. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Hi, Joe. Fine. Thanks.
You are a founder of a new group, and it's called Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Can you tell my listeners a little bit about that and when it got started?
Sure. Back in December, I found myself in the midst of a discussion using the internet with about a dozen experts on different aspects of the case, and it seemed to me it might be a useful idea to create a kind of informal affiliation among us by creating an entity that could speak for the group, organize conferences, lectures, things like that. To my surprise, there was some resistance from a couple of members who said they thought it would infringe on their freedom of speech somehow. That puzzled me, but I realized that I didn't need their permission to do it. I invited Steve Jones, who was, making headway with an analysis of the physics of the collapse of the Twin Towers, to join me as co-chair, and went ahead and founded the society on the 15th of December. By the end of the month, I had 50 members. By the end of January, 100, and now we're something over 200.
And these are knowledgeable people, right? This isn't just...
Yeah, we've had so much interest that I've broken down into different categories of membership so that the full members have academic affiliations or the equivalent. Then there are associate members who have backgrounds and experience that are relevant to analyzing issues here. Then there are student members, self-explanatory. And then there are society affiliates, which are just persons who want to identify themselves with a group. The vast majority of our members are in the first two categories, as you would expect.
What was the specific reason? I mean, do you feel that the media just hasn't taken charge on this issue, or do you think that they just think that it's over with and done with and there's nothing more to tell?
Well, I think there are a lot of factors going on. One, of course, is corporate ownership of the mass media. I mean, it's a small number that are most influential. CBS, Time Life, New York Times. I've been particularly disappointed with the New York Times. I mean, this catastrophe occurred, literally blocks away from the New York Times, with the death of some 3,000 residents of New York City, and it's hard for me to believe that the Times could abdicate its great tradition of, printing all the news as our nation's newspaper of record and fail to come to grips. It's very analogous to their failure to come to grips with the death of JFK, frankly. I have never been more acutely disappointed in a single news source than the New York Times on 9/11, because the evidence is overwhelming, the physics is elementary, the consequences are devastating, and anyone who simply looks at the basic evidence in this case cannot but be completely convinced that what the government has been telling us is not just a lie, but a massive lie, that the government has actually been using violence and threats of violence to instill fear into the American people in order to manipulate us for political purposes, which means that if you stop and think about it, the American government has been practicing terrorism on the American people.
The New York Times, they held back a story involving the NSA eavesdropping case for over a year, which may have led to George Bush being reelected.
Yeah, that's absolutely unbelievable that they would withhold a story like that for over a year. I mean, personally, I'm convinced, because Donald Rumsfeld accounts himself something of an efficiency expert, that they're actually, it can't possibly be true, as Scott McClellan claims, that they're only listening to Al-Qaeda conversations. So he wants to defend the right of the commander-in-chief to listen in on Al-Qaeda conversations in the conduct of war. No one would argue with that, but that's not what they're doing. They're surveying vast numbers of the American people. In fact, I conjecture they're surveying everyone's conversation and email using the sophisticated computerized apparatus, and then performing data mining to determine who they think is of a special interest. And this is why they wanted to cut off immediately, in a peremptory way, which is their fashion, any investigation or exploration of what's going on here. It's just not like Rumsfeld to curtail any enterprise that he considers to be necessary, regardless of whether it's legal, illegal, Congress has approved or disapproved. Rumsfeld is a person who just assumes authority unto himself, and in my opinion, is as great a menace to democracy and the rule of law as the United States has ever had in the position of Secretary of Defense. The New York Times, of course, also, in the form of its reporter Judith Miller, constantly reiterated the administration's line about the existence of weapons of mass destruction, Saddam involved in in cahoots with Osama and things like that. Utter ridiculous nonsense coming from our nation's most important and influential newspaper. Completely disgusting. Completely and totally disgusting. I'd like to believe that the New York Times could take the lead even on issues like electronic voting machines, which are stealing elections right and left before our very eyes. They were used to steal elections in Florida in 2000 and in Georgia in 2002, in Ohio in 2004. I don't know how much evidence the Times would need to persuade it that there is a major problem here. But if it has any dedication to democracy, the Constitution, and the rule of law, then they ought to be conducting themselves in a very different fashion than they have been.
Well, and Diebold machines have been proven to be hacked, and that's just a fact.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, this is one of my areas of interest. I studied computer science and artificial intelligence for a year before I came to Minnesota, and I have published a lot of stuff about the foundations of computer science. This is the most elementary algorithm you could have. It's taking a number n and adding one to it to produce a new number n prime. There's nothing to it. There's nothing proprietary, nothing mysterious, nothing technical, no reason whatsoever to deny the public access to this kind of information. In fact, the very idea that the counting of the vote should be in the hands of private companies that have strong political ties to one party or another is so completely corrupt that Europeans can't believe that we would allow it to happen. And in fact, in Ohio, the owner of the company said how they were going to do everything they could to deliver Ohio to George W. Bush. Well, how absurd can you get? Stalin observed that it doesn't matter who casts the votes, what matters is who counts them. And this appears to be a lesson that the Karl Rove, for example, has taken to heart.
I want to start with and go by, we don't have a lot of time, but I would like to start by going through a timeline, because all of these things seem to just follow right along. We have the stolen election in 2000.
With a catastrophic Supreme Court intervention, which was a decision that was completely improper and is going to be a black stain on the history of the court.
I couldn't believe watching some of the footage of Gore refusing to discount that and not
his most magnificent moments were resisting this overthrow of the American government that was taking place before our very eyes in Florida with the complicity of the court.
So 12 months later, or less than 12 months later, comes the 9/11 attacks.
Yes. All for the foundation for which has been laid in the past by the very clique that comes into government in key positions, including Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, in the form of this document from Project for the New American Century, signed by some two dozen neocons, offering a vision of the future in which American power is projected around the globe to create an empire greater than that of Rome, where the crucial part involves putting American forces into the Middle East because of its strategic significance. I'm convinced we're there for three reasons: oil, ideology, and Israel. Israel is the one country that had legitimate beef with Saddam Hussein because he was giving $25,000 bounties to the families of suicide bombers, and the Israelis didn't like that. But I'm convinced, too, that we're pumping, you know, vast quantities of Iraqi oil out of the country off the meter. And, of course, the ideological motivation was the most profound. It turns out now we have 3 to 4 huge bases that are quite clearly of the permanent base variety that are being constructed in Iraq. I think it's obvious that the reason there was no exit policy for leaving Iraq is that the administration has no intention of exiting. So that, you know, some of these things become more obvious the more you pay attention to it, just as the intervention in Afghanistan appears to have had negligible to do with Osama bin Laden, a great deal to do with a pipeline where we had sought to negotiate with the Taliban and told them that if they would allow this pipeline to be constructed across northern Afghanistan, that we would bathe them in gold, and if not, we would bathe them in bombs. They didn't, and we did, and now we have 2 or 3 major bases in the north of Afghanistan right along the route that pipeline is going to take. The president of Afghanistan is a former Unocal company official, and so is our ambassador to Afghanistan. So I think when you start putting some of the facts on the table, that it doesn't take rocket science to figure out what's really going on here.
And we're very concerned up here because, as you know, Canadians have taken some of the control of the NATO forces over there, and we are very worried about our sons and daughters dying for oil.
Well, of course, that was part and parcel, too, of the Project for the New American Century, which can be read online. So anyone can go on and put in Project for the New American Century, and this document will pop up. Where the neocons were even stating in the document that because Americans are so accustomed to democracy and so uninterested in empire, because it would be so fantastically expensive, and because it would cost so much in terms of human sacrifice of their own sons and daughters, just as you're reflecting in relation to Canada, that they were most unlikely to be supportive of such a project, save for some traumatizing event, such as, and they use this phrase, a new Pearl Harbor. In fact, a few years earlier, in a book published in 1997, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, in a book entitled The Grand Chessboard, had laid out a similar scenario, given the United States was now the sole remaining superpower. I mean, these people are basing, predicating foreign policy on a corrupt moral principle, which is might makes right. Because we can do something doesn't mean we should do it. I mean, I think the psychological trauma that Americans are undergoing here and coming to the realization that their government has been lying to us and performing terrorist acts on the American people is analogous to a wife discovering her husband has been molesting his daughter. I mean, it's so overwhelmingly frightening psychologically that accepting that it's taking place becomes, you know, a source of psychological paralyzation. But it's like cancer. I mean, you know, you hear the phrase, what you don't know can't hurt you. Anyone who has had cancer, as I have, knows the absurdity of the idea that you can just ignore things and that they're going to get better. What we have to do is come to grips with the truth here, which is that this administration has not merely been molesting the country, but actually conducting acts analogous to rape and pillage. I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. Most corrupt administration in American history, bar none. I have no doubt about it. I've been saying this for years, and the evidence is overwhelming.
Well, and I listened to a past interview with you, and even if you were Republican, you've stated several things about Republicans, and so it's very confusing, I think, for the outside world to look down or over there and see why are Republicans supporting this administration when he doesn't stand for Republican ideals at all.
Joe, you put your finger on a key point. I mean, I don't understand. It's as though they're power mad, as though they're, you know, their greed has exceeded their sensibilities. I mean, as a young man growing up, my father, who was a student of political science, explained to me the principles for which the Republican Party stood. Those included balanced budgets, a constitutional government, a non-interventionist foreign policy, keeping government out of our personal lives, and states' rights. Now, all those were worthy principles that constituted a block, an ideological block that at least deserved respect. But this administration violates every one of those. We have the most massive deficits in American history, now running up toward $9 trillion.
Which is unfathomable. I mean,
it is. Anyway, by the way, I mentioned as an aside an astounding historical coincidence, which is on 9/10, the day before these events transpired, Donald Rumsfeld was reporting to Congress that the Pentagon was unable to account for $2.3 trillion.
Out of the Pentagon.
Isn't this astounding? The day before 9/11. So, of course, 9/11 wipes all memory of this off the books. You know, no one can hold the Pentagon accountable. Isn't it a fascinating coincidence? Just as Donald Rumsfeld on 9/11 was saying there were going to be more events, you know, of this kind. You know, he's more or less anticipating something like that the Pentagon might be hit. Very, very curious remarks when the Pentagon, for example, is the most highly defended building in probably in the entire world. But then the idea of, you know, constitutional government, the Patriot Act was rushed through, practically no members of Congress even read it, and it vitiates, you know, so the Fourth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, and of course we're having all kinds of attacks on the First Amendment, mere freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and so forth. And then we have, of course, the idea of a non-interventionist foreign policy. What I find so ironic here is that not only does our invasion of Iraq violate international law, the United Nations Charter, and even by its linkage to the UN Charter, the United States Constitution, but that the rationale Bush offered, namely that, you know, we had the perception that the interests of the United States might be threatened at some future point in time by this by this regime was precisely the same of Emperor Hirohito advance for attacking Pearl Harbor. So that if Japanese interests were involved here, and they felt the United States was some sort of threat, and indeed it turns out that we were actually seeking to interdict and deny Japan access to oil in the South Pacific. But I mean, the Bush doctrine might just as well be described as a Hirohito doctrine. So that if September 7th, 1941, is a day that will live in infamy, then I think we're going to have a similar characterization of the invasion of Iraq, no matter how rapidly it took place. Look at the catastrophe that has ensued. I mean, there were really very good reasons why George Herbert Walker Bush, even though he had the massive power and could easily have done so, declined to take Baghdad. And then if we continue on the traditional Republican principles, I mean, the idea of keeping government out of our personal lives and states' rights, I mean, repeatedly, overtly, I mean, the Terry Schiavo case in Florida is just one dramatic illustration where the federal government, in the form of Tom DeLay, for example, in the House of Representatives, and Bill Frist in the Senate, opportunistically, for purely political reasons, intervene in or attempt to intervene and even try to pass special legislation that would affect a case that had been working its way through the Florida courts for 15 years, where all the evidence was on one side and none of it on the other. And here they were, but just in a grotesque abuse of political position, intervening, just as they have done in Oregon in relation to medical marijuana laws or death with dignity. They have no right to do this. It's not constitutional. The states have propriety over matters that aren't specifically allocated to the federal government. I mean, it's such a loss of the very notion of the rule of law. And in fact, then you have members of this administration, including the present attorney general, who want to support this doctrine of the unitary executive that even places the president above the Constitution. I mean, this is a complete and utter abdication of the American form of government. It's the manifestations of a form of dictatorship, and it's something that I cannot understand why any self-respecting Republican who has believed in the party of the past could tolerate today. It's a form American-style fascism.
Well, it's anti-American, actually.
Anti-American, anti-democratic, unconstitutional. There's quite a list here. It's grossly abusive. It's utterly corrupt. It's not just illegal. It's profoundly immoral, because what you have going on is a small group that are making decisions on the basis of whether or not it benefits the group, regardless of the consequences for others. So when you get those massive tax cuts that Bush initiated by using telescoping techniques, just as Enron had, taking the projected Clinton surpluses, treating them as though that were money already in hand, and massively cutting to benefit the rich, that was grotesque. Single-handedly by itself, it has put the country trillion upon trillions of dollars into deficit. And then, of course, withdrawing from the Kyoto Accords, for the sake of short-term corporate profits, we're going to run the risk of jeopardizing the future existence of the entire human species? I mean, that's the sort of thing that's going on here. It's crass, it's calculated. The government has been placed at the disposal of major corporations, particularly the gas and oil companies, who have had this crucial role in formulating our foreign policy. And, of course, they envelop it all in secrecy. The American people don't even know what our foreign policy is.
This is one of the strangest aspects of the year 2000 is the energy policy, which remains still to this day unavailable to the public. What could possibly be in an energy policy that would derive it to be, it has to be secure and it can't be available to the public?
It's because it would reveal the whole game. It would show that the map was to go into Afghanistan and get in, put in that oil pipeline, dump the Taliban. It would show we were going to go into Iraq and we're going to make sure there would be no petro-euro conversion. It would show we're going to try to slice off this little sliver of Iran where 90% of their oil deposits are located. It would show we're going to try to depose the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, twice popularly elected. Anyone, you see, one of these foreign leaders is like Fidel Castro, a foreign leader who tries to do good things for his country, who believes the natural resources of their country, whether it's Cuba or Venezuela, ought to be put at the benefit and disposal of the people of Cuba or the people of Venezuela. And if that involves, for example, appropriating properties that were wrongly put into the control of American companies like Anaconda or United Fruit in Cuba, the companies immediately turn to the American government, claiming that, you know, these are communists who are doing these acts. I mean, it's an easy claim to make because, I mean, after all, they're reducing the profit margins from these American corporations by depriving them of the natural resources they've been exploiting in these countries. And the fact that these are nationalistic movements that are intended to improve the quality of life for the people of Cuba or the people of Venezuela, or go back to Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, for crying out loud. I mean, have we learned nothing? These nationalistic movements are terribly important, and from the moral point of view, they are completely well-founded, because these are leaders of nations who are trying to improve the life and well-being of their own people and to stop the exploitation of natural resources and cheap labor by big multinational corporations, where, in fact, the whole, you know, globalization now really is intended to eradicate all national boundaries, all sovereign laws, all anti-pollution, environmental protection, worker right, labor right laws and so forth, and just trample them under the massive power of the World Trade Organization. It's a frightening scenario, and it's being advanced aggressively by the Bush administration.
Let's go back to 9/11, and you have pointed out very specific things. I don't want to say anomalies, because we're just not sure that these things happened. These buildings falling the way they did.
Yeah, well, the only problem with the official account is that it involves violations of laws of nature, which alas can't be violated and can't be changed. So it's just fine as long as you're willing to believe impossible things. Just to make a few elementary points, the melting point of steel is approximately 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, but the highest temperature a jet-based fuel fire could attain is about 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit if it's fed pure oxygen, which means there's a 1,000 degree gap between the heat from the fires that were caused by the plane crashes and the melting point of steel. So the steel did not melt. In addition, Underwriters Laboratory had certified the steel for up to 6 hours at 2,000 degrees temperature before it would even significantly weaken. Not only were these temperatures not hot enough to reach 2,000 degrees, they were relatively brief in duration. The South Tower fell after less than an hour, the North Tower about an hour and a half, which means that the steel not only did not melt, it did not even significantly weaken. The buildings were designed to withstand the impact of airplane crashes. 707s were the largest commercial airliners at the time they were built, between 1966 and 1970. But the 767s which hit the building are very similar in their properties and so forth, their mass and their configuration, etc. Frank DeMartini, who was a project manager for the World Trade Center, remarked that the impact of the load redistribution capabilities of these buildings, which were largely dependent on these 47 steel core columns that went up the entire structure, were so sophisticated that the impact of a plane or even multiple crashes on the building would be like sticking pencils through mosquito netting. So evidently the planes didn't cause the problem, and the melting of the steel didn't cause the problem, and the weakening of the steel didn't cause the problem. And you have these billowing black clouds of smoke, which are indicative of an oxygen-starved fire, such that UL even estimated that it was the temperature of the fire were nowhere near 1,800, but probably closer to much around 500 degrees Fahrenheit, much, much too cool to have caused any of these effects. And yet you have the buildings collapsing abruptly, completely, symmetrically, straight down and enveloped with this massive cloud of dust, which is the conversion, the pulverization of the concrete used as a flooring material into very fine dust, which required a separate and independent source of energy. It cannot have been from the fires, and it cannot have been from the impact of the plane. So the question becomes, what could possibly cause this to happen and produce the result that these buildings came down at free fall speed, so that if I'd been on top of the South Tower, for example, and released a grand piano, that building would have collapsed at the same time the grand piano hit the ground, except where the grand piano would have thrown up dust and debris when it hit the ground, this building was throwing off dust, debris, steel columns outward and even upward from the top down.
We saw a building in Madrid, and I can't get that picture out of my mind, is those steel girders in Madrid. The building burned for 2 days, and it's just the building stood there.
No steel structure high-rise has ever collapsed due to fire before 9/11 or after 9/11, and I assert, nor on 9/11, because those buildings, the only explanation for all of the effects that we find in these buildings and indeed in World Trade Center 7, which collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon after Larry Silverstein, who leased the World Trade Center, had suggested to a fire commander that perhaps the best thing to do would be to pull it, which is a construction term for controlled demolition, which implies the existence of previously positioned explosives in order for that building to be brought down, again at free fall speed.
And they couldn't have wired that building that day.
No. Oh, no. There's too much going on, firemen everywhere. They couldn't have done it that day. In fact, there were security lapses or odd security problems in the Twin Towers the 2 weeks before 9/11, where large sections of the building were shut off. Employees were told to go home, and teams of so-called engineers were being run in and out. Steve Jones of BYU, who's been analyzing the physics of the situation, believes that the type of explosive used was this stuff that's quite devastating to steel called thermite, that there's an enhanced form with sulfur called thermate, and more recent suggestions from members of our society, for our group of scholars for 9/11 Truth, suggest it could be a nanotechnology, this microtechnology enhanced version that's hundreds, even thousands of times more powerful than the ordinary thermite, that would have brought it down, and then able to account for these vast pools of molten metal that were found at the sub-basement levels 3, 4, and 5 weeks later. I mean, this is just astonishing. That stuff would get up to temperatures of over 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit had it been used, and Steve calculated that 40 men making 10 trips apiece could have been sufficient to implant enough thermite in the building to bring it down.
So is it a proven fact that people were actually shutting off the building and there were teams going in?
Oh yeah, they were always shutting. They were shutting off of the security cameras, and you know, they had explosive sniffing dogs that were not doing their normal thing. And yeah, this was the outfit that was responsible for security is something called Securicom. One of the directors of which happens to be Marvin Bush, the president's brother. Just as you know, Florida so conveniently goes for Bush in 2000, you know, and then there are other weird things going on in Florida in 2004. I guess it's very convenient to have your brothers in these key positions.
That's amazing to me. Securicom, is that what you said?
Securicom, yeah.
Let me ask you a question. Even if the temperature did rise to 1,800 degrees at the top of the building, I know steel is a conductor, but there's no way that would it conduct that heat all the way down the build to the?
Well, you
make
a great point. I mean, it's a great thermal transmitter, meaning you heat up a piece of steel and it distributes it throughout all the sections of the steel. Which means, of course, it means that you're talking about an average temperature. I mean, this is a kinetic molecular phenomenon that simply means the only way in which you could have any melting of the steel or even weakening of the steel would be for the whole floor, the steel in the whole floor, to have significantly melted or heated. And that just wasn't going to happen at these temperatures. I mean, the whole story is a fantasy.
And during the cleanup, there was a suspicious way of removing this debris, correct?
Yeah. And I meant thermal phenomenon, yes, by bringing in an outfit by the name of, get this, Controlled Demolition Incorporated, which was also used to remove the debris after the Mura building was blown up in Oklahoma City, which also had any number of peculiar aspects to it, including the discovery of unexploded demolition charges inside the building after the facade had been blown off. I mean, so controlled demolition is carting off all the remnants, the steel and so forth, which is a crime scene. It needs to be subjected to forensic analysis. And you had the firefighter chiefs and so forth, and you even had the newsletter or magazine for the fire officials saying that this was all improper and it shouldn't be done. And yet the mayor, here we have, you know, Giuliani was promoting it and insisting that it should be cleaned up right away. This is all very, very peculiar and, of course, in retrospect, incredibly suspicious. Giuliani had actually been in the World Trade Center 7 and claimed that they were warned that the towers were going to come down and they had to scramble to get out of the way. I guess they thought maybe the building was going to fall on them, but in fact, of course, they came more or less straight down, apart from this huge enveloping cloud of dust debris, which was blown, you know, hundreds of feet outward and even upward, that had to require a separate form of energy because it could not be accountable on the basis of the airplane impacts or the modest fires that took place thereafter. So who was telling Giuliani this? I mean, if it never happened in the history of structural engineering before that any of these buildings had ever collapsed from fire, what's going on here?
Wasn't there an enormous amount of gold that was taken out from the building? Is that true?
Yes, there's some staggering quantity. I mean, I think in excess of $1 billion of gold that was stored in vaults beneath the World Trade Centers. And, you know, there are a lot of mysterious stories related to that. It's not unlike all the put options, which were stock market wagers that the stock for American Airlines and United Airlines, and I think Dean Witter, one of the big stock market companies, were going to fall, where the Securities and Exchange Commission has extremely detailed, meticulous information. You know exactly who placed these stock transactions and so forth, and yet a huge amount of the money that they earned because of the stock falling in the aftermath of 9/11 has never been picked up. I mean, if there were a serious investigation to find out the truth, that's one of the first places you'd want to begin. Who would have sufficient foreknowledge that they'd be able to anticipate the stock was going to drop and therefore they would make millions of dollars by purchasing put options?
And that information wouldn't just disappear by the World
Trade Center's
fall.
This is some of the most tightly regulated information. Now, it's also interesting, the World Trade Center 7, which came down when Larry Silverstein said pull it, had the Securities and Exchange Commission offices in it. It had Secret Service offices. It had the command and control for the city with two floors with their own air and water supply. This has to be one of the most robustly constructed buildings in world history. It was built over a huge electrical generator providing power to lower Manhattan, so they had to take extraordinarily precautions to ensure that that building would never collapse on the generator. So it appears to have taken a special, design or use of explosives to bring it down. Its free fall time would have been 6 seconds. It fell down 6.6, very close, but I think not quite, because, you know, the way in which it was designed was so solid. So the actual technique used in bringing down 7 appears to have been different than the technique used in 1 and 2. And you notice when 7 comes down, there's not this huge enveloping cloud of dust at the top. It doesn't explode from the top down the way in which 1 and 2 do. I mean, if you just look at that cloud of dust, you got to understand that building is exploding from the top down. It's not collapsing and then a huge cloud of dust coming up from the bottom. So the smoking gun is right there before your very eyes. I defy anyone, after hearing what I'm saying, to look at those buildings and not understand that they are exploding from the top down.
And there don't really like this movie. It's called In Plain Sight, because I think it plays conspiracy music and it makes it seem kind of too strange. But in that movie, they do show an explosion that happened.
Well, I think In Plain Sight has taken some hits that it probably didn't deserve. For example, it starts off showing four different images of these pods underneath a 767 that hit the Twin Towers. Now, I had a press conference in front of the United States courthouse last Tuesday, suggesting that the wrong prisoner was in the dock, that if foreknowledge was sufficient for the death penalty, then Dick Cheney appeared more deserving than Zacharias Moussaoui, because Dick Cheney appears to have been a perpetrator who obviously then had foreknowledge. So if foreknowledge is sufficient, obviously the perpetrators had foreknowledge, and that therefore is sufficient, based in part on Norman Mineta's observations of what was transpiring in an underground bunker as a plane was coming, or whatever hit the Pentagon, was coming toward the Pentagon.
Can you tell my listeners just about that real quick? Because I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So an aide, here's Mineta in this underground bunker observing Cheney in charge, and an aide is coming up and saying, sir, it's 50 miles away, sir, it's 30 miles away, sir, it's 10 miles away. Do the orders still stand? And Cheney turns on him, nearly bites off his head, and says, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? Now, The aide, you would think, well, maybe, you know, was the order to shoot down the plane? If the order had been to shoot down the plane would have been shot down. They've got anti-aircraft batteries and all other kinds of stuff. You think those brass hats with $400 billion, financing available to them year after year after year aren't going to make sure they're the best protected in the world? So the order had to be to not shoot it down, and that obviously would cause alarm. I mean, to think of shooting down a commercial airliner, okay, you might say, well, of course, you're going to have some compassion for all the passengers. But look, if you don't shoot it down, it's going to impact the target, and more people are going to be killed. You're not only going to lose all the passengers, you're going to lose everybody else who's then killed, and all the destruction wrought in the plane. So it can't be the case that the order was to shoot it down. The order had to be to not shoot it down, which obviously would cause alarm in any aide. And therefore, we take it that Cheney actually was coordinating all the events on 9/11 from this underground bunker, and Mineta just happened to observe the last stage in the unfolding sequence.
And part of the government's explanation is that they scrambled jets, but they didn't have time to get there. Do we really think
that... Well, you got to understand, there were three, four, or five different operations, training operations, that were simulating the use of airplanes, as weapons and crashing into buildings and so forth that morning. And all the normal FAA and NORAD coordination mechanisms were suspended so that, air traffic controllers, when they're looking at a screen, couldn't tell if, it was real or it was Memorex. Was this part of the training op or was it not? And this all caused massive confusion. Several commentators have observed that if merely standard operating procedure had been followed when these aircraft were taken, control of, however it was done, and it turns out from my research that the 757 and 767s are the two types of aircraft in the air that could be controlled remotely from a distance or from the ground.
And they've had that technology for a long time. I mean, that's not...
Yeah, but these are two type of commercial airliners that have that capacity.
Right,
and
right.
So, you're right. And so that, the whole thing appears to have been a charade. I mean, when Condoleezza Rice comes out and says that, no one could ever have imagined using these weapons, these airplanes as weapons, that's completely absurd. The Pentagon had a simulation a year before of exactly what would happen if a 757 hit the Pentagon. And you may stop and say, well, isn't that interesting? Because then it gave them an idea of what the crash scene ought to look like if it were to happen. But the entry point there is much too small. It's only about, before the upper floors fall, the entry point of the Pentagon is only about 10 feet high and 16 feet wide. You may not be able to believe that. Go on st911.org, go to the resources page and scroll down. And the first photograph from the Pentagon is the impact point or the hit point before the upper floors fell. And you're going to see there are cars there, there's a fence, there's unbroken windows. There's no possible way a Boeing 757 hit the building there.
There's no possible way that a 757's tail hit that building.
That's absolutely right. And that building, it has a limestone facade, so that you see a very clear impression if a plane had hit it. I mean, limestone is a relatively soft form of stone. And it would have made a very clear indentation. You find no debris from the fuselage. You don't find the wings. You don't find the seats. You don't find the passenger. You don't find the luggage. I mean, you hear about, airliners losing your luggage, but this is absurd. It should have been strewn all over the place. The tail is one of the structurally soundest parts of the plane. Even the engines, which are virtually indestructible, were not found at the scene.
I'm not sure if they covered it up or not, but we didn't see big trucks coming in there and removing lots of debris like that.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, the fire chief, first on the scene, was embarrassed when a reporter asked him, did you see parts of the plane in there? And he said, no, he hadn't seen any parts of the plane inside the building. This is the fire chief. Now, you got two scenarios. One is, if the plane came down at an angle, then you'd have a huge crater, such as we see from normal plane crash sites elsewhere in the world, which we also, by the way, don't see in Shanksville, where that other plane is supposed to have crashed. In fact, a colonel who was with me in front of the, who is a former Air Force officer, was responsible for aircraft investigations, told me that at Shanksville it looked as though they brought a bulldozer out and carved a gouge in the ground and put some trash in there and blew it up to make it simulate or look something vaguely like. He confirmed, by the way, that these apparent pods at the bottom of those planes, he thought actually were features of the planes, and that therefore they appeared to be militarized versions of 767. So here I'm saying in plain sight, I think, seems to have taken some hits it doesn't really deserve. I think in plain sight is very good, and loose change is even better, and there's a loose change second edition that's probably the most valuable DVD out there right now, but we have many other resources available for the public that are for free, all available on our website at st911.org.
So we don't have much time, but I do just want to talk about this timeline a little bit more. We have the stolen election in 2000, we have 9/11, we have the rise of the industrial complex, we have businesses like Halliburton, their stock is up 500%, we have missing trillions of dollars. All of this seems to be going in a certain timeline that benefits a certain group of people, and it doesn't benefit the American people.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And if you want to hear a chilling, how about these reports that Halliburton has now been given more than $300 million to construct a series of camps across the United States? in case there are problems with immigration, we'll stop and think about it. They don't need all these camps for immigration problems. This appears to be a precursor of the concentration camps of Nazi Germany. I mean, it's just absolutely petrifying to see this government, stealing elections, lying to the American people, manipulating information, conducting a surveillance now on all the American people, and I'm convinced that's what's going on. I mean, these are all tactics of totalitarian states. I mean, these are supposed to be the things we're fighting against. I mean, how can we pretend to be fighting for democracy and freedom in Iraq when we don't have democracy and freedom at home, when the rule of law has been suspended for some kind of some new form of presidential dictatorship? I mean, it is chilling to the bone.
Well, and I think it was Senator Lindsey Graham who stated or wants to pass legislation against fifth columnists. Have you heard about this?
Yes, and it's frightening. I mean, I have thought that Lindsey Graham was a good man and a principled person, and that he had a great a potential political future. But coming up and suggesting that Americans who have dissenting views, I mean, to criticize your government because you believe your government is wrong is the highest form of patriotism. And for Lindsey Graham to be suggesting that those who are publicly critical of the government should be treated in ways that subject them to legal penalties, you know, harsh fines or prison sentences, is completely outrageous. I say Lindsey Graham has lost his way and doesn't deserve to represent the people of South Carolina insofar as they care about democracy, the rule of law, and constitutional government.
Well, where does America stand right now? I mean, we're going to have to go soon, but from a point of view from here, it seems to be that not all, but a certain amount of Democrats are working in tandem with this extreme right-wing Republican administration. They don't seem to be standing up and challenging this administration, or not in a way that would cause any real effect. Where do you stand right now?
I couldn't agree more. I think the Democrats have turned up to be a group of spineless wimps, and they're not standing up for the country. They're not standing up for the Constitution, and I don't believe they deserve to be returned to Congress either. I think in this next election, if we can have our votes actually counted by getting rid of these electronic voting machines, and I'm very gratified to see legal moves taking place to not allow these electronic voting machines to be employed in multiple states, even being brought against the Secretary of State of California, where in the secrets of night, after having an expert panel report to him about all the problems with these machines, he went ahead and certified them anyway, a completely outrageous act. I say that the whole Congress has to be reconstituted, that during the election here we have the opportunity to vote on every single member of the House of Representatives. I say, Democrat or Republican, get rid of them. Send new people into Congress. Send Americans who care about their country back, because the degree of corruption in this Congress is so overwhelming that I cannot see them changing. I cannot see them, developing the attitudes that are going to be conducive to the restoration of freedom and democracy in the United States. And one-third of the Senate is up for grabs. And I say, if those people have been supportive of the Bush administration, Democrat or Republican, get rid of them. We have to recapture our country, and it's much better that we do that peaceably by means of the ballot, assuming we can get the restoration of a legitimate mechanism for counting the votes, than that we have to endure a second American Revolution, because I believe these people are so enamored of their power that they're not going to relinquish it, and that ultimately they're going to want to use the American military against the American people. And while I would like to believe that the military officers have enough sense to recognize that they not only do not have the duty to obey illegal orders, they actually have a duty to actively oppose them. If the American military succumbs to the political pressures from these neoconservative fascists, that I say American citizens may have to take it upon themselves to fight the good fight. And therefore, I'm with the NRA in believing the Second Amendment really does mean we should stock up on weapons and automatic weapons, armor-piercing bullets, anti-tank, bazookas. I say, go whole hog. My God, I now think that these independent militias and so forth that are scattered around the country, about which many of us used to have profound skepticism, may actually be an important part of a resistance movement to a military takeover by this fascist clique.
Well, and we're almost already seeing that in New Orleans, because you have these even private groups like Blackwater USA that are roaming the streets, mercenaries.
Oh, it's frightening. I think the whole thing in New Orleans appears to me have been contrived. Obviously, that the hurricane was going to hit was telegraphed. We knew it 5 days, 4 days, 3 days, 2 days in advance. The Bush administration did nothing to cope with it. FEMA used to be the most admired independent agency in the world under the Clinton administration for its professionalism and its efficiency. I believe the situation was deliberately allowed to deteriorate until Bush could send in the military as though the cavalry had arrived. And I was asking questions and publishing columns about what is the 82nd Airborne trained to kill doing in New Orleans when the Louisiana National Guard trained to cope with national emergencies is off in Iraq. I mean, you know, having these National Guardsmen in Iraq damages and weakens the National Guard. Having these trained killers in New Orleans does no good for the people of New Orleans. I mean, what's going on here, just as I see this whole business about the bird flu, which hasn't even evolved to the point where it's actually transmissible human to human. But Bush has been out there talking about using the military to impose quarantines. It's very clear to me that this is a subtle policy to undermine and vitiate the Posse Comitatus Act, which forbids the use of military forces to perform police functions, because if he can undermine that, then sending in the military to police different cities in the throughout the different states could at least have some flimsy legal pretext, whereas it cannot now, as long as Posse Comitatus stands. So that I think this, which I used to think was a rather obscure doctrine, now turns out to be terribly important when you envision the prospect that they may want to precipitate another phony terrorist attack in order to dump the Constitution and declare military law and send our own forces into our own cities to defeat us, and you know then use these camps to reallocate the political dissidents that they've identified by the massive surveillance. So all of these things appear to me to be interconnected. And, I just say, if someone wants to suggest that's a conspiracy theory, well, what we have going on here appears to be a conspiracy. And, in fact, you can't deny the existence of conspiracies, because if you believe in the government's own account of 19 foreign hijackers taking these planes under control of a man off in a cave in Afghanistan, that is a conspiracy theory itself. So the government's advanced a conspiracy theory, one we can prove is false. So it's been perpetrating massive lies on the American people. It appears to have been behind and orchestrated these events in New York City and at the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania. So it's been using acts of violence and threats of acts of violence to instill fear in the American people in order to manipulate them to promote its own political purposes, which, as I observed way back in the beginning, in case you check it, is terrorism, which means that the American government has been practicing terrorism on the American people. We must confront it. Unfortunately, the evidence is all there. All you have to do is connect the dots.
Is it possible to, do you think that that America could provide a forum for that? I mean, what do you do?
Well, you got to get the word out, and the mass media have not been responsive. For example, when we had this press conference before the federal courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, there were a dozen cameras there, television cameras there. There were three that were right in the center. We were speaking before three. There were five microphones. I was enumerating findings from more than a dozen members of the Scholars for 9/11 Truth by name and their specific findings and what they meant, including the incapacity, for example, for those persons of those meager state of training to have flown those planes, the impossibility for cell phone calls to have been made from those planes, which implies how thoroughly and detailed this whole thing was fabricated by even, I believe, synthesizing some voices and then, you know, using this as a kind of vivid way to connect psychologically. This was appears to have been a very clever psychological operation, but the media didn't report it. I mean, the only outfit that did is a small group called Wing TV, which were there and reported about what we had done. But the mass media, not a sentence, not in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Washington Times, the LA Times, you know, the Chicago Tribune. You go through the great papers of the country, and none of them are reporting this. So what in the world is going on? We had uncovered in the past, in the course of research I've done on JFK, that the CIA has had these agreements with a major media, including, you know, an article written by Carl Bernstein as long ago as in 1974, published in the Rolling Stone, where officials of the CIA were boasting about their agreements, especially with Time Life, with CBS, and with the New York Times. And if you can control those three outlets, then you pretty much have a lock on the major media, because these reporters, the last thing they want to do is be embarrassed they're like a lot like faculty. Faculty, the last thing they want to do is be embarrassed. So they tend to go very conservative. I mean, it's not true that tenure emboldens faculty to speak out. That's a very rare thing. And it's very rare in the media that anyone actually seizes what's going on. They've cut back on their investigative journalists. They're all just parodying the government's line. It's all very shameful. I mean, you know, I think Benjamin Franklin talked about if they were going to have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, they'd prefer newspapers without a government. But that's to presume the newspapers are doing their job, which they manifestly are not. And, of course, the mass media in terms of television, I mean, it's unbelievable. You have some channels like Fox that are nothing but propaganda outlets for the administration in their effect, in their impact. So if you want to know what the government's latest line, just tune into Fox because you're going to find it.
It seems to be a quite incredible process that they have set up. And
I'm so disgusted with the New York Times. I mean, I cannot be sufficiently emphatic about the absolute failure of leadership by the New York Times, because here's the one preeminent American newspaper that could actually take a leading role to expose the charade and save the country from a dire fate. And their failure to do so is something that can never be forgiven and can never be forgotten.
Well, and their actions prove that they're doing absolutely the opposite, which would be to actually protect the administration. And
you're so right. I'm so sorry. It's so disappointing.
Well, I think what you're doing is good, and I think that more people, and especially distinguished people like yourselves, need to stand up. Smart people who understand that what we have here is a conspiracy by this administration and by a small group of people in Washington that is having a great effect not only on America but on us here in Canada.
Yeah.
And around the world. So.
Well, anyone who wants to see the substantiation for all the claims I've been making can go to our website, st911.org, and you're going to find, for example, a whole coverage about the press conference, the statement I made, the coverage that was given. We have Mineta's testimony on tape, which the 9/11 Commission received but didn't include in its report, just as they included nothing about the collapse of World Trade Center 7, just as they've ignored the fact that 4, 5, or 6 of these hijackers have turned up alive and well and living in Saudi Arabia. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that if they were killed in airplane crashes on 9/11, they can't still be alive and well and living in Saudi Arabia, which has even been confirmed in some cases by the Saudi Arabian embassy. So, and yet the FBI has not sought to revise its list of who was supposed to have been responsible. I mean, the whole thing is so shameless and so shocking and it's so blatant and it's so much in your face. If anyone has any doubts about it, please go to ST911. You might also want to sign our petition because we're calling for the release of all kinds of documents and records the government has suppressed and withheld from the public, which would expose the charade being perpetrated on the American people.
Okay. I have been speaking with James Fetzer, and he's a professor of philosophy at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. And I want to congratulate you on what you're doing, and I wish you luck in the future, and I hope we can speak again about this.
Well, I hope so too, Joe. Let's hope.
Okay, well, you have a nice afternoon.
You got it.
Okay.